Thank you very much, Dr. Zhang, for speaking with Voice America. Chinese President Xi Jinping made a rare visit to Xinjiang in July, his first visit there in 8 years. How do you read the timing and the purpose of this visit?
It is quite interesting that Xi is visiting Xinjiang for the first time since 2014. Given the risks in the area and the fact that a bomb attack occurred during his last visit in Urumqi in 2014. So I think his visit really demonstrates that the Chinese government feels very secure now about the general security in the area, about the success of central government policy, and about the fact that, you know, Beijing is in firm control over the region.
Speaking of the security, we noticed that Xi Jinping's public remarks in Xinjiang did not mention eradicating extremism and separatism, which Chinese officials have long cited as a rationale for their severe Xinjiang policies. Why? What's your take on this?
My take is that, as Xi himself also remarked in 2020 at the third Xinjiang Work Conference, that Xinjiang has made great progress or success in regards to the central government's attempt to eradicate extremism. Of course, this did occur through brutal re-educational brainwashing. But from the central government's perspective, it clearly appears that China has been successful in eliminating the problems of extremism that it sees there, or at least that's what it publicly portrays. If you look at some of the internal government documents, they often are far more alarming than what the government says itself. And actually, if you look at some of the Xinjiang work reports, like, for example, the report for 2021 published at the beginning of this year, and other reports that are not quite as outward facing, the tenor still is that Xinjiang still faces arduous challenges with stability. But I think Xi Jinping's visit here was to send a message of confidence.
According to the Xinjiang police files, it was during and after the 2014 visit that Xi Jinping laid the groundwork for the crackdown, the mass detention, surveillance, and other, you know, controversial Xinjiang policies. Do you expect any new policy or policy change after his 2022 visit?
I think this policy change has already taken place. We can see that under Chen Xuanguo, Xinjiang was implementing a very intensified campaign-style mobilizational approach, mass mobilization for mass internment, mass mobilization into labor transfers, etc. Everything was high-powered. It was police state style. It ultimately quite unsustainable. Now, an internal Chinese academic report called the Nankai Report said that the internment camps were an effective and necessary short-term measure, but that the long-term measure is development and labor transfer and poverty alleviation. I think we are seeing this shift, which I analyzed in my publication from June this year. We are seeing that under Ma Xingrui and under the new, the 14th five-year plan for the region, there's now a focus on sustainability, on long-term development, away from this highly mobilizational campaign style, a way of governing and policymaking, to a more institutionalized, a normalization of coercive labor, of coercive poverty alleviation, and of securitization, including people locked up in prisons still for a long time.
You once wrote the preemptive internment of large numbers of ordinary citizens can be explained as a devolution into political paranoia that promotes exaggerated threat perceptions. Would you please elaborate on this? What do you mean by political paranoia?
Political paranoia is a concept that has long been developed by scholars of mass atrocity, scholars of genocide, people, academics who have studied the likes of Mao, of Stalin, of Pol Pot, of Idi Amin, of Hitler, of other regimes that implemented mass atrocities. And it was clear how a paranoid mindset that exaggerates an existing threat, but very limited threat, exaggerates it to an extent of justifying the preemptive internment or oppression or even destruction of an ethnic group that's framed as a threat. In the case of the Uyghurs, yes, Uyghurs have perpetrated acts of violent resistance. They have committed knife attacks, even attacks we could call terrorism to an extent, small minorities, of course. So this threat is construed as this incredible threat emanating from the entire ethnic group, where every Uyghur has the potential to somehow become this monster in their minds and take a knife and kill somebody. And so then in the mind of the central government and the government, you have to take them and preemptively put them in camps to make sure that they don't become dangerous because they're already untrustworthy. And so the dynamics of political paranoia explain how a regime can suddenly shift into a mode of mass internment, of mass oppression, in order to satisfy its own fears, basically.
What's the cause of this kind of mindset? Is there any kind of deep reasons behind it?
Well, it is likely a need for control. Autocracies typically feel a need to control a situation. And if you have an entire ethnic group that you feel you can't control them and are not trustworthy, that's how this develops very quickly. You have kind of this, of course, these kind of dictatorships already produce their own internal paranoia. I mean, if you look at Putin and how he surrounds himself with the security services and trusts nobody, or Stalin before him or others, all have their own security services layers, so prevent any opposition. There's no trust in these systems, and these systems breed paranoia.
Given the paranoia of Chinese government, is international pressure working in terms of, forcing them to change their behavior in Xinjiang?
International pressure adds a significant and important long-term cost to the equation. So I think it's not possible to say international pressure is the one thing that's going to somehow change everything, especially not now, since much of it has already happened now in Xinjiang. But international pressure creates a long-term cost variable that adds to the equation that can make a difference if it comes on top of domestic challenges. And it looks like China is facing domestic challenges, economic challenges, and that could make a difference in the medium to long term.
In June, the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act went into effect in the U.S., barring products from Xinjiang unless companies can prove that forced labor was not involved. How would you evaluate this law?
Well, this law directly was based on and follows my recommendation from my research paper and testimony at the CCC Commission, the hearing in October 2019. And so I basically argued in my work and my testimony that that the U.S. government needed to assume that goods from Xinjiang are tainted with forced labor because we have two large systems of forced labor coexisting and operating. And so I'm very pleased that finally, with a long delay, but still better late than never, the UFPLA was enacted and is in force. And now it is a matter of enforcing it and of an ongoing monitoring mechanism to monitor not just the situation in Xinjiang, but to also monitor forced labor situation to other provinces. And my latest research shows that the normalization and institutionalization of labor transfer in Xinjiang is actually dramatically changing the evidence situation, meaning we now have less specific evidence implicating particular companies, as was the case under the highly mobilizational labor transfer campaigns under Chen Xuanguo in the previous years. And so it's all the more important that we have a mechanism such as the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act that says everything coming out of the region could be tainted with forced labor and therefore is unacceptable.
But some people have raised concerns over, the other side of the coin. For example, they argue that as a U.S. business withdraws from Xinjiang, Uyghurs living there might be driven into poverty. Are you concerned about that?
I'm not sure that any single American company has made this argument, but it's, of course, very likely that Chinese companies have made this argument. But regardless of whoever made this argument, a lot of the business or much of the business in the region, especially the labor transfers, labor transfer takes very low-skilled Uyghurs, very, very low-skilled Uyghurs, and puts them into factories that are set up with expensive subsidies from the central government, from Eastern China. So the factory bosses are Han Chinese, and a lot of those are benefiting from the system are Han Chinese. So those whose profits are getting impacted, not dramatically because many of them can still sell domestically, those whose profit margins are impacted are almost overwhelmingly Han Chinese business owners. The effect on the Uyghurs would be marginal. And if Uyghurs are hit, those would be the wealthy Uyghurs. The poor Uyghurs will not be affected.
Another concern would be how to fulfill the climate change commitment of the U.S. with the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. Because with the help of forced labor, China has been the dominant supplier of the raw materials used in solar panels and electric vehicles batteries. So the enforcement of the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act means the U.S. has to, you know, rebuild the whole supply chains of these industries, which might drag down the transition to new energy. Do you think the U.S. has to choose between, you know, fighting against the climate change and against the human rights violation in China?
Well, the White House is already choosing between this because the Biden administration has, in fact, exempted several of the polysilicon producers that are implicated from the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, to the dismay, of course, of human rights activists. Obviously, China is producing very inexpensively solar panels. That's a situation that's quite recent. Many solar panels were produced in the past in countries like Germany, and they were brought to China due to the systematic advantages and government subsidies. So in many ways, it's the only right and ethical thing to bring business in solar panels back to countries that have ethical labor principles and don't irresponsibly and illegally boost the sector through government subsidies.
What would be your suggestions for the U.S. to do next in terms of helping ethical ethnic groups in Xinjiang?
Work together with allied countries, work together with Europeans, the European Union, work together with Britain, with Canada, with try to work with Belt and Road countries and developing countries, even though it's difficult, provide alternatives so that we don't have a situation where a Chinese company makes goods and says, oh, these goods we cannot send to the US, but we can sell them to Africa or to Europe or to Canada. And that would be a big mistake. So I think the United States cannot just act on its own. Also, you know, with the genocide determination pressure at multilateral institutions, the UN should exert pressure at the UN in Geneva. It should try to exert pressure at all kinds of multilateral settings in order to work towards a difference. The US cannot do this by itself.
According to a recent Reuters report, China is asking the UN High Commissioner Michelle Bachelet to bury a highly anticipated report on human rights violations in Xinjiang. What's your expectation for this report?
It is my understanding that this report is going to be of a nature that's going to make Beijing rightly very, very concerned about it. And China's actions are indicating that the report, that Beijing obviously believes that the report could be quite damaging to its reputation. And from what I am aware of, I would agree that this report, yes, very likely, and almost certainly, hopefully at least, is going to be quite truthful to the situation on the ground. So I'm not surprised that the Chinese are trying to stop it. Ultimately, of course, Michelle Bachelet herself is going to make some sort of decision about what's going to be in the report or not. And that, of course, is a major concern. But I think there's a lot of pressure also on her, and this process is being very closely watched. So hopefully she's not going to tinker.